Dial through classic rock stations.
There must be some kind of way out of here.
Flip through classic cable channels.
You what?
I said I was your agent and that you were wanted for a big musical on Broadway, and Doris Sherry said they didn't want to stand in your way, so they released you from your contract, and thanks to me, you don't work at Metro anymore.
Put the key in the ignition. Turn the thing, and it went...
This is your order?
I knew it was the only way I was going to get to see you tonight. So we're still on for dinner?
We know a classic when we hear it, but in decades, will we? Will there even be classics with all this information coming at us? Or will we all live in our own little silos choosing our own classics? Slate Magazine takes a stab at this question with a list called The New Classics, things from the first 11 years of this century that will resonate years from now. They asked for reader feedback. Boy, did they get it. John Swansburg is the culture editor at Slate. He joins us from their studios. John, do you believe there will be classics? When I Love Lucy was on, there were just three channels.
It's never been easy to know what a classic would be. And, you know, Moby Dick came out in 1851 and was kind of dismissed, got mixed reviews. And it took almost 50 years before people rediscovered it and understood Melville's contribution. So we've always been bad at knowing what our own classics are, what the classics of the moment will be. But you're right. It's hard to know 50 years from now whether our current idea of the classic will even exist.
Right.
There's so many songs, so many books. It's so much easier now for anyone in America to create a YouTube video. There's no more, there are fewer controls over who can be an artist. So it's hard to know.
Well, you made a very controversial nomination. The Black Eyed Peas, I Got a Feeling. Let's just listen to that for a second.
That tonight's gonna be a good, good night.
Everybody jump up and down like Fergie. And John, you say, love it or hate it, it's function hall immortality. In other words, every wedding that's ever going to be held at a function hall is going to have it. But readers hated this. Why? What did they say?
They did. They called the song a quote, watery piece of tripe. That was one response that I got. I think that this song really infuriates people just as a song. I mean, I think I know a lot of people who love it, including my fiance, who has demanded that it play at our wedding next month. But there are other people who really despise the song for some reason. It just kind of pushes people's buttons. I think maybe because it has this kind of empty message of tonight's going to be a good night, although I find that kind of nicely optimistic. But I chose it as it was a somewhat tongue-in-cheek selection, but it occurred to me that, you know, we live in this time where there's so much music around. You know, my parents' generation, not only could my mom probably not hum any top 40 song right now, she probably doesn't even know half the genres that some of those songs come from. It's such a fractured musical landscape that it occurred to me that in thinking about what pop song will endure, I needed to find a song that would live on for some other reason. And I think one reason that this song has a chance of being heard, you know, 20 years from now is that it's been played at every wedding. It's probably played at every bar mitzvah, in part because they say Mazel Tov a couple times. It's not going away. It's such a fun song to dance to. It is so relentlessly positive that you want to hear it when you get together with your family and you're dancing. So I think for that reason alone, it'll survive. And it's a kind of a different kind of classic.
But here's what goes on. We were waiting to talk to you, and we couldn't help but overhear your engineer there, Chris. Chris, are you there?
I am indeed here.
Yeah, so even Chris is chiming in, John, and telling you what a terrible choice that was. What did you say, Chris?
I mean, I just think that it is a slightly more, yes, watered-down version of much better party songs, and the one I specifically brought up was R. Kelly's remix to Ignition, in which Mr. Kelly extols that it's the freaking weekend, baby, and I'm about to have me some fun.
A similar message, and I have to agree with Chris. Remix to Ignition is another classic, I think, for that reason.
That's why I'm all up in your grill, trying to get you to a hotel. You must be a football coach, the way you got me playing the field, so baby, give me that.
It's so fun, and I would actually argue that it's the better song.
Well, so John, this is what your life is like. Chris, thank you. You can go back in your little box now. But this is what it's like, and we want listeners, as we speak, just go ahead, bring it, you know, what your suggestions are at hereandnow.org. Well, let's move on to memoirs. You say Bob Dylan's Chronicles is the one that will be classic, and I'm thinking, you know, Bob Dylan, he's from the 60s. What about Dave Eggers, you know, his heartbreaking work of staggering genius? Explain your decision there.
Well, this was actually Ron Rosenbaum, who's a columnist for Slate, who mm-hmm. selected this. But I thought Ron's choice was an interesting one because we do think of Dylan as being a author of classics from another era. But we saw this new side of Dylan in his memoir. You know, we saw him his writerly side. So I think that's what motivated him. But I think you're absolutely right. There are other memoirs that were written in the last decade, including Eggers, which could be considered classics. And if we had a longer list, certainly they might have made it.
It's no surprise you nominate the iPod as just like something that changed everything. But then some of the recommendations from readers included the Toyota Prius. That's a pretty good one. And then this was odd to us anyway. It sort of jumped out. The Star Wars kid. This is the video of the teenager. He's got brown hair. He's, you know, maybe a little pudgy. He's going wild with what looks like a lightsaber, but it's actually a golf ball retriever. Let's listen. This is one of the first videos. It's 2002. It's one of the first videos to go viral. And you know, even writing this up, you remind us that the Star Wars kid, this almost killed him, you know, because people started picking on him, and it became what, a sort of a symbol of the good and the bad of the internet?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We wanted to choose a viral video because that's a new art form from the last 10 years. I mean, it's really a creation of YouTube and broadband internet. So it felt like this new artistic form that could be canonized. And we chose Star Wars Kid because it was an early example of that. It happened back in 2002. And it also, like you said, it sort of showed the good and the bad. The good in the sense that this anonymous 15-year-old Canadian teenager who was a real fan of Star Wars could go from complete anonymity to being kind of a star of the internet. But then also the dark side. I mean, he became the subject of mockery. The original video was remixed kind of constantly. There, if you go and search Star Wars Kid on YouTube, you'll find the original video, but also all these other permutations, some of them very funny, you know, where someone has added lightsaber, like a true lightsaber effect, and other ones quite cruel, and there's a lot of cruel commentary on the web, and I think that the Star Wars Kid himself felt a little persecuted by that, understandably. But, you know, that kind of encapsulates the sort of viral video experience. Obviously, there are many, many others we could have picked, but that one felt like it was early, and it kind of anticipated the Rebecca Blacks that were to come. Rebecca Black being the author of the song Friday, which was a hit recently, the kind of truly awful song. I mean, it makes the Black Eyed Peas look like Beethoven by comparison.
John Swansburg of Slate, which recently posed the question, what from the first 11 years of this century will be considered classic 50 years from now? And John, as we've been saying, you looked at books and movies. But let's look at the TV commercials. Someone nominated the Mac versus PC ad in which Slate says Apple successfully portrayed the PC as nerdy cubicle drones and Macs as affable loft-dwelling operatives. Let's just listen to a little.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC. What are you reading?
Just the Wall Street Journal. It's nothing. Oh, no. A PC? You know what?
Oh, it's a review of you.
Don't read it.
Oh, it's from Walt Mossberg, one of the most respected technology experts on the planet. Apparently, you're the finest desktop PC on the market at any price.
Really? Do you think that's going to stand up the way, let's say, the Volkswagen ads did with the Nick Drake music you write about them?
Yeah, well, they don't work for everyone, but they've been very influential. There are now a lot of ads that sort of have followed their lead. You know, the current T-Mobile campaign is essentially just a riff on those ads. And they really did, I think, come to help consumers understand the differences between those two products. And they really helped make the PC mm-hmm. look like a lame product and the Mac seem like a cool product.
I would vote for the babies, the talking babies. or the Geico.
I find talking babies are very divisive. I'm very against talking babies, but maybe, you know, I'm also, you know, pro Black Eyed Peas, so, you know, there's no counter for taste.
Yeah, right. And again, listeners, herenow.org, we want to hear from you. One of your colleagues nominated HBO's crime drama The Wire. Let's just remind ourselves, remember the character Omar. He makes his living robbing drug dealers. Here he holds up dealers playing poker.
Yeah. All right, everybody, let me see them hands, yo. Hands! Yo, banker, cash me out, yo.
That's my money.
Man, money ain't got no owners. Only spenders.
You know, John Swansburg, again of Slate, I'm thinking that classic television is usually a show that makes you feel all warm and fuzzy about your adolescence. You know, it's like the Wonder Years. This is not that.
That's true. I mean, here's what I'd say about The Wire and the reason I think it was a good choice. There are two reasons, really. The first is that I think The Wire really showed people the power of serial television and sort of changed people's opinions about what was possible. If you take the five seasons of The Wire together, they really capture the social, political, and economic life of an American city, in this case, Baltimore. And that was an amazing accomplishment. It feels almost Dickensian in its sweep. And I, you know, The Sopranos had done that to some extent, too, but I feel like The Wire really showed that television is this amazing art form that hasn't fully been tapped. And then the second thing is, The Wire is very specifically about Baltimore, the way its people talk, the way its drug dealers do business, the way its city hall works. But it also has these themes that are timeless. It's about the frustrations of bureaucracy. It's about the temptations of corruption. And those are things that are going to be with us, sadly, for decades to come, I fear. And I think that no show has ever showed the dark side of city government quite that way. And I think for that reason, it'll stand the test of time.
For fashion, one of your editors nominated Uggs. And, here in the New England area, we've got our quarterback, Tom Brady, the Patriots. He's become a spokesperson for Uggs.
Yes.
And people are finding that just horrible. this sports icon is, new fashion icon in these Uggs. But why? Why did you guys pick Uggs?
Well, I'm grateful to Tom Brady for standing up for Uggs because I feel like, he's such a great masculine guy. And if he can pull it off, then maybe I can pull it off and I can go around in a more comfortable boot.
While you listen to the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah, exactly. I've been trudging around in my L.L. Bean boots for all these years. Those Ugg boots that my sister wears look much more comfortable. So Simon Doonan, who works at Barney's and writes for Slate, he suggested the Ugg, I think, in part because he felt like it was where comfort meets glamour. But if you, are inventive and you have enough swagger, I think you can pull it off.
In sports, the question, who will be, the Babe Ruth, the athlete that everyone knows even if they don't know sports? And someone at Slate nominated Roger Federer?
Yes, our sports editor, Josh Levine, suggested Federer. Federer has just he plays the game at a moment where tennis has become a real power game. And yet Federer has found a way to compete in the power game while just seeming incredibly elegant and playing in what looks almost like a classic tennis game, but hitting the ball as hard as his competitors, if not harder. And Josh pointed to a few YouTube clips of shots that Federer has made that are just, they just look superhuman. There's one where Andy Roddick has slammed what clearly should be a winner into the deepest recesses of the court, and somehow Federer just has this balletic leap, and he returns not only keeping the ball in play, but he hits an unbelievable winner. And you watch a shot like that, and you just feel in your gut that you're watching a player that only comes around once in a generation. And I think those are the kinds of players that that we do think of as classics. It's obviously weird to think of a person as a classic, but
yeah.
It has that same Larry Bird-esque feeling about him.
Yeah, magic. Well, it's, in fact, we have some sound from that shot.
After the shot, it was so ridiculous that Roddick actually took his racket and just threw it over the net and just sort of in defeat.
I give up.
Yeah.
I want to make sure we've mentioned writing because, what will be the classic? What will be the Kerouac, the On the Road, the Salinger, the thing that everyone will know? Alexander Hamon's Nowhere Land.
Right. Well, this is another a choice that I think was controversial because this was actually chosen by a colleague of mine, David Haglund. But he doesn't have the audience that I think he deserves. He's an immigrant who sort of learned English as a second language and actually learned English by reading Nabokov, which, if you can believe it, and his prose actually reflects that. And he's a writer who, he's writing essays for The New Yorker now. I feel like he is someone who we may look back in decades to come and decide, wow, I can't believe that I lived at a time when he was flourishing and I wasn't reading his books the day they came out.
Yeah.
But he's a controversial choice. We didn't choose someone like Jeffrey Eugenides.
And some of the other readers said, what about Cormac McCarthy, The Road? That's the debate.
Would have been a more conventional choice for sure.
Yeah. Well, your choices are fascinating. Your choices of categories are fascinating. Why did you decide to look at typeface? I mean, Helvetica, it will be so yesterday. The one to watch is Clearview. Really, typeface, that's something that, I guess so. When I think about it, I think I can picture, classic typeface from decades ago.
Right. I mean, this was another one that was a little bit cheeky because we don't even necessarily think of typeface as part of this kind of bar stool conversation. I don't know how many people are sitting around right now, you know, arguing about typeface, certainly maybe graphic designers. But one of my colleagues, Julia Turner, is a student of signs and of typeface, and she selected Clearview. And Clearview, you may not know you know it, but you do, because it's recently been introduced as the new font that are on all of the highway signs. And it's much clearer than the highway signs of yore. And so it's not just an aesthetic matter. This typeface is actually making American roads safer. And it's one of those things that it's so part of your everyday life and you don't know it's there. We wanted to bring it to the attention of readers, and it does have has a different feel, and I think in the future we may look back and see how, you know, its effect on driving patterns and traffic and accidents, and really be thankful for that change.
Did you get any, you know, pushback on that? People saying, "No, you're out of your mind. It's Arial," you know.
I don't think anybody stood up for Arial, but I do think people probably sort of raise an eyebrow about whether a typeface made sense on this list. But no, I don't think we had any Arial or Courier fans out there who stood up, although I kind of wish they had.
John Swansburg, culture editor at Slate. Again, for your thoughts, we'll have the whole list of categories here and now.org. Love to hear from you. John, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Robin.